Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Why do we do all this? Why are we so anxious about desire? Just give me your top of mind thoughts. What's frightening about wanting? And I'll say it in the microphone. You might not get what you want. You might not get it. Right. They might say no, and then you have to confront the rejection and the disappointment. You may hurt someone's feelings. Very good. So my desires might be destructive or hurtful to somebody. Maybe they're wrong. That's a good one, right? I may want it, but I may be screwed up, right? and it will expose that I'm screwed up. So it's vulnerable because we're vulnerable to rejection and disappointment. We're vulnerable to exposure, right? That what we want is off base. And we're vulnerable to having to confront whether or not it's hurtful, you know, whether or not it's destructive to someone else. Any other thoughts about why wanting makes us anxious? I think you guys got them, actually. So it feels vulnerable. And I think it's so much easier to demonstrate that someone should give you what you want than it is to own what you want. And you can't control, as someone said, you can't make someone give you what you want. And so if you know you don't have control and you have that vulnerability, then you'll manage it in some other complicated way. So let me tell you about how I did this, okay? When I was dating my now husband, I didn't want him because it was too risky. You know, I, having grown up in the church, really felt like once I got married, that I would lose power and that I would become vulnerable. And once I was had, I would be devalued, right? And so I really found a sense of the way I got around that, the loophole, was if I could just let myself be wanted but never want, then I get all of the love and the admiration with none of the vulnerability, right? It's a great system, right? So he did all the wanting, and I could feel wanted and feel secure but never have to actually want him back and make myself vulnerable. So the way I actually managed or justified it, and I see people do this all the time in my office, even though they're married, is I devalued him, right? I basically made him I wasn't quite sure that I wanted him. And if that was really true, I could have broken up with him and moved on. But no, I'd kind of say I wasn't quite sure while still staying in a relationship with him and keeping him sort of in a position that made me feel invulnerable. And surprisingly, he kept wanting, right? luckily for me, actually. So, until he started to date someone else, and then I became frantic. Okay, I was frantic because now I didn't have the security of him doing all the wanting, and it forced me, if I was going to keep the connection with him, then I would have to want. I would have to actually put my neck out and say, I care about this, right? I care about you. I want you. And I would say in many sexual relationships and marriages, we let, you know, if we're the lower desire person, we let our spouse be the custodian of desire. We let him do the wanting. We let him do the seeking, the yearning, the, you know, and we, that, you know, you can say no to sex. What allows you to say no to it is knowing that they're going to do all the wanting, that they're going to keep the connection because they're in pursuit of it. It's only safe to say no when you know that they're going to keep wanting you, right? As soon as they decide, like in one couple I have been working with, he wants, and she would never want. And then after a while, he would give up, like that, I don't know if this marriage is going to work. And when he was literally disinvesting and would start kind of going towards the door, you know, in the marriage, then the desire would emerge in force. It's not that the desire wasn't there, right? It's that only when she was going to lose the security did she let herself feel the wanting, right? And many relationships work out a dynamic in which that gets split, right? And it keeps us from having to want. It keeps us from the vulnerability of valuing the person that we're with, of letting ourselves know that we're actually dependent on them. And I'm sorry I keep saying this. I'm going to be talking about this more tomorrow. What does healthy dependency look like? So it's just easier to react to someone else's desire. And as Trish, my friend from Boston, said, that, you know, it's an easier relationship to yourself in many respects to just be reactive to someone else's wants. I'm just going to give one more example around the anxiety of desire, which is another couple that I've been working with. When they first came in, she expressed frustration about him always, that he was dominant in the relationship, meaning in the marital relationship. His wants dominated. What he wanted was what they did. What he thought was right was what they ended up choosing. The vacation spot that he thought was best was what they would do. And this was getting old for her, you know, 15 years into marriage. And so she was getting depressed and anxious, and that's kind of was the thing that brought her into therapy. And so he came in and he really started to confront what he was doing. His children were less interested in his adolescent children were becoming uninterested in being in a relationship with him. They didn't want to feel controlled by him. And he really got it, and he confronted himself, and he started pulling back from that position. And so, but then she had to then realize that once he was being more decent, right, and not controlling, that now she was suddenly overwhelmed with fear because she couldn't let him do the wanting and then just react to it and be resentful. Now she had to start defining, who am I in the void of him not trying to define and control me all the time? And that terrifies me to think about who I am. That means I have to actually start taking risks. That means I have to actually start expressing who I am in the world, and maybe it's going to be insufficient. Maybe I'll find myself really lacking, right? So it became clear to her how that system had worked for her also. So what I'm here to say is that, and I'll tell you what I mean by differentiated if you don't know, but poorly differentiated people really fear vulnerability. The vulnerability of wanting, the vulnerability of being known. And so, as I've alluded to, that Murray Bowen is a family theorist who lived several decades ago, who talked about differentiation within families. And basically, his theory, which is, I think, an excellent one, is that when we're born into the world, we can't help but filter our sense of self through our relationships, because we have no other context for knowing ourselves. And so we make sense of how valuable we are by the way that our parents respond to us. We make sense of who we are by the way the world reacts to us. And our mattering, how important we are, is really kind of is taught to us by the ways that our relationships define us and tell us how important we are. So the thing is, though, that as a child, it makes sense that external validation is your only reference point. But when we really mature and grow up, then it's around whether or not we dare to own a reference point within ourselves, whether or not we can start letting our own experience and reality start to help us shape who we are. And when people are enmeshed, which is the opposite of differentiated, they remain highly dependent upon the validation of other people around them. They do not dare to develop more relational autonomy, which is the ability to know themselves and be true to themselves, right? So just to give an example of that is that, okay, this is a good one. My 9-year-old really likes the song, what's it called? Can't remember. Doesn't matter. I can't remember. Oh, I wish I could remember the name. He just loves it, okay? This is some song he loves. Oh, I just want to remember because it's cute. Okay, I can't think of the name. But anyway, he loves this song, so he downloaded it from iTunes, and he's listened to it with me on the computer 100 times, and he just loves it, right? And then he goes to school, and he tells a friend of his that he really likes that song. And the friend says, "Seriously, dude? That song's totally lame," right? Okay, so he comes home that night and he says to me, "Yeah, I don't like that song anymore." And I said, "You don't?" I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because, you know, Scott at school said that song was totally lame, right?" So I said, "Well, why does Scott's opinion about that song matter more than your opinion about that song?" And he's like, "I don't know." He's like, "Mom, don't be a therapist right now." And so I said, "Okay, no, I just think that your opinion is at least as legitimate as Scott's opinion, right? And so, you know, maybe it's okay for you to just like it because you like it. Well, I don't see why his opinion should matter more, right? So that's the point, right? Which is, can I hold myself as, you know, we know ourselves so well, and then oftentimes when we walk into a situation, we turn that self-knowledge off, and we totally start thinking about who we are through someone else's eyes. Right? And that we betray ourselves in that moment. Right? We betray our own value, our own legitimacy, our own perspective, and we undermine our strength when we do it. And I think spiritual development and emotional maturity is really based in that. You know, I think we have two systems in the church. We have the sort of the authoritative, this is the doctrine, the top down, kind of this is what's true. There's value in that, right? There's structure. It gives us shape to what it is that we want to at least push up against. But then we have another system, which is that of, you know, the spirit, personal revelation. And I think many of us, when we're undifferentiated, don't dare to actually have our own understanding of what we feel is true. That we feel like we have to comply with what everybody else thinks we should be, how we should believe, how we should feel. We don't actually dare listen to what it is that we feel is right for us, what we believe works in our lives, right? And I think there's a kind of spiritual autonomy that can happen. It doesn't mean that we're all right, but we are at least expressing the truest sense, you know, our genuine sense of what we really feel is right, not just trying to comply to what other people think so we have their esteem, so we get their validation. And so I think our maturity is really developed as we do that. And I think we become more confident in ourselves and, more able to hold on to who we are, even in the context of people wanting different things from us, you know, wanting us to conform to reduce their anxiety. You know, relationships will always put pressure on you to conform to what they want because it makes us more comfortable when people want the same things we want. But if we can hold the integrity of who we are, not in an oppressive way, but just by owning what we know about ourselves, then that's what is the mechanism in relationships that really pushes us to grow. You know, I teach the marriage and family relations class in my ward, and I talk about this idea that, you know, we often think that marriage is there to make us happy. And if we find the right person, then we will be happy. And I think a gospel principle is that marriage is in fact there to make it painful enough until we actually grow up and develop and become more grounded, loving people, right? That it exposes our immaturity. It exposes the ways we can be hurtful. And if we're going to depend on validation from the other person, we're toast, right? It's not until you can start confronting yourself, letting yourself see yourself, flaws and all, and really having the courage to develop into something stronger than someone who just needs other people's approval, but someone who can actually look for their own approval, their own integrity, their own ability to act and do the things that they believe are right. That's really what allows us to become loving, grounded people and people capable of passion. So someone who's differentiated, as I said, you can hold your knowledge when people see things, self-knowledge when people see things differently, but you can hold that you matter even when someone is being devaluing of you. Brené Brown is a researcher on the concept of vulnerability. And if you, probably if you go on YouTube and you put in Brené Brown, I think it's B-R-E-N-E, and B-R, what's that? Yeah, TED.com. Did you say B-R-O-N-E? Oh, okay. Brené, oh. Okay, B-R-O-W-N-E is her last name, right? And her first name is B-R-E-N-E, okay? So she talks about vulnerability. And one of the things she talks about is that what she calls the kind of wholehearted people versus the, I don't know what they were, the other people, the wholehearted ones, they embraced their vulnerability. They were able to be vulnerable, to let themselves be open and knowable, to kind of take risks, to want things, you know, to basically, they sort of embrace the vulnerability of life. And the difference between the people who were able to do that and the people who weren't was simply that the ones who did it really accepted that they mattered, that they were worthy of love and acceptance. And the people who really struggled with vulnerability and exposure had deep questions about whether or not they really mattered. I think in our theology, we have a concept of God loving us and that that love is immutable. It can't be changed. There's no amount of righteousness that can make you worth more than someone. There's no amount of sin that can make you worth less than someone. But I think the courage is in actually accepting that idea. Because most of us, those of us striving to be perfect, you know, don't buy it. You know, what we really think is I've got to earn my value. I've got to earn it through denying my humanity, denying my imperfection, and trying to be acceptable, presentable. If you can really accept that you matter even though you're deeply flawed, which we all are, we all matter and we're all profoundly flawed, and if you can tolerate that reality, then you open yourself up to really being known to yourself and to someone else. And if you can't confront that in yourself, you will always have a wall between you and the other person. You know, one of my clients, I have an exercise that I give couples sometimes around hugging as sort of the first sort of intervention. And partly to diagnose what's happening in their sexual relationship, but also to help them develop something within themselves. And so this couple, she tried it for the first time, and she talked about the anxiety that she felt around hugging. Just, it was just a simple hug, you know, clothes on, standing up, hugging. But the deep anxiety that she felt standing there hugging her husband. And I said, what do you think the anxiety was about? And she said, I was afraid that he would see something in me that I wasn't willing, that I wasn't ready to have him see yet. Right? Which I think is really profound. Like, I don't want to be known. I want to be validated. I don't want to be known. And that's what most of us are looking for in marriage. But that's an immature position. Any questions or anything before I say more? Yeah.
Those words are just kind of going through my mind. I want to be validated. I don't want to be known. But perhaps there is a way that if we allow ourselves to be deeply known, we can be fully and deeply validated.
Yes. You're right. So, I mean, I think good sexual relationships are a combination of that ability to validate ourselves and hold who we are and a nice dose of validation in return. Right? But there's nothing, and that's the heaven on earth, in my opinion, is when you really can let yourself, you can hold the legitimacy of who you are enough to let yourself be known that deeply and to feel that accepted. Is it your spouse has also been able to develop themselves enough that they can accept you that deeply, even if it's different, right? Even if it's not what they wanted at first. There's nothing freer, more freeing and lovely than that. And that's what I think makes it transcendent. So, but I think all of us want that, but we're too terrified to ever get there. Because what if I don't get the validation and what if I face rejection? Which often we do, right? That's the tension of marriage, is when you start exposing something about yourself that they don't want you to expose. And then their anxiety goes up and they try to, you know, shame you into retreating back to where you were so that their anxiety will go down. So I think our self-development, and it may be a little redundant because I'm jumping around a little bit, but our self-development is, it's really linked to desire. What do I want versus what do others want from me or for me? And living by your internal compass or discovering it and expressing it, expressing your unique abilities, your unique perceptions, your unique desires, and being true to them, you know, that's a true expression of you. If you're living your life, if you're living the life you think others want from you, if you're having the sex that your spouse wants to be having, then sex and life is not going to be a true expression of you. And therefore, it's not, you're not going to want it, right? Because no one wants to submit to the tyranny in a chronic way of what other people want from them. So when sexuality is not an expression of self, it can't be intimate. And because you're not actually showing up. And you'll come to resent it. No one wants that psychological loss of self. Sorry, I always have this struggle between notes and just talking to you, because if I just talk to you, it's more alive, it's more passionate. But then I'm like, okay, wait, did I say that part? And now I'm saying it again. But okay, so it's really in that ability to hold onto ourselves and validate ourselves that will give us the courage to actually start to explore who we are in the world. Like in my client, with my client who always took what her husband wanted to be the reference point, that it required for her an ability to hold on to herself enough to start taking the risks of exploring what she wanted for herself and to start letting those be exposed to her and to her spouse and to others. The same as in the sexual realm is if I'm going to start, you know, let me say it like this, like a lot of people, like I have a client who says, I have no sexual desire. And kind of like, you know, I just didn't get it. Like everybody else maybe got that gift. I didn't get it. And hang on. But see, I see sexuality as something that you develop. It doesn't, meaning you have the capacity, biologically speaking, but everyone needs an erotic education, right? Everyone needs to learn how to both integrate this reality and who they are and develop it and find ways to express who they are within that language. And if you have just been too afraid of the language, you'll never learn it. It's kind of like if you say, I can't speak German, but you've never spent any time daring to learn, it doesn't mean you don't have the capacity to speak it. It means that your anxiety around learning it has precluded you from mastering it, right? So if we can validate ourselves, though, and validate the imperfection and validate the exposure, then we start giving ourselves the place and space to start defining who we are in the sexual realm. So, you know, all sexual development requires anxiety regulation. So you think about your very first sexual experience of any kind, you know, kissing. So just take like French kissing. French kissing, the first time I heard about it, sounded pretty much disgusting to me, right? But if you then your anxiety tolerance is, okay, well, I'm going to try this thing and I'm going to see, you know, I'm going to step towards this thing that makes me uncomfortable that I haven't yet mastered. But if you can tolerate that process, then you can either include it or exclude it from your repertoire, your sense of if this is something that I like or I don't like. You know, that's how all sexual development happens. I mean, remember the first time you hear about intercourse, it's just like, what the, you know, that's really what God says we have to do. And yet, if you actually confront your anxiety enough to actually explore it and understand it and experience it, then you start to integrate it into a sense of who you are. So that's the process of I'm willing to tolerate the anxiety of my ignorance or my not knowing enough to find out more about me and what I want.
Okay. I always think of Sleepless in Seattle, the big O word. So is orgasm tie to all of this anxiety threshold, etc.? Can women have an orgasm if they're doing what the other half wants them to do, or does it have to be tied to their own reference point, their own internal compass?
So I'll talk more about orgasm tomorrow, but I'll say this much, which is, yes, it has very much to do with anxiety. And the more anxiety you have, anxiety has an inhibiting effect on... So if you're totally anxious, not the productive anxiety that I've been talking about around stepping towards something that's unknown to you, but you're overwhelmed with anxiety, it will inhibit your body's ability to have an orgasm, okay, because it decreases the stimulation that you get. But what was the second part of your question? Can you do it? Yeah, that's the other thing I would say is that, and I'll talk more about this tomorrow. Sorry to keep saying that. But, you know, the skill that people have in healthy sexuality is an ability to belong to themselves and to others, right? It's a function of differentiation. That I can belong to myself and you at the same time without feeling those two compete with each other, which in an undifferentiated state, we feel like those two realities are in competition. The reality about pleasure in sexuality is if you won't give yourself the room to have pleasure for yourself, I mean, it requires on some level a kind of trust in the relationship that you can go and attend to yourself without it hurting the other person. And if you don't believe you can do that, that your desire and your wanting is inherently destructive, then you're not going to give yourself the space to let yourself have that experience. And you do, to achieve orgasm, you do need to be able to pull away and trust that the relationship can tolerate it. Trust that the relationship can tolerate it. There's a question here.
So earlier you also said that sex can be either duty-based or desire-based, but can be both. But what you just said just now kind of... So when you said that, I was a little confused because I consider myself to have a pretty healthy sex life with my husband. And every once in a while, there are times when it is more duty-based, but then it can transition into this desire-based and always does, right? So that's what I was confused with what you just said. Okay.
Yeah, I think we can sometimes maybe enter in out of a place of I'm not really wanting it, but I guess I want to want it, or I want to because I care about you, and so I want to kind of enter into this conversation and see where it goes. I think if you stay in the duty framework, it's definitely going to inhibit what's possible. I mean, you may even be orgasmic, but it's not going to be the same kind of communion. It's not going to be the kind of communion that... You can start from that place, yes. And I would say many women don't start, I mean, what's his name? The sex researchers, I just can't say their name all of a sudden. Masters and Johnson, thank you. That the model is you start out with desire and then there's arousal, climax, and recovery. But that's just not true. I mean, most people, often people start with arousal, that they just start letting themselves be touched and their body starts to respond. And desire is actually a decision. Desire is like, my body's aroused, but am I going to own the wanting? Am I actually going to let myself claim it and step into it? Because my body might be responding, but not, I won't let myself let the wall down. So, yes, okay. One other thing I was going to say is that, part of the linking of our self-development to the capacity for desire is being able to tolerate that process of coming to know yourself. But it's also not thinking about sex anymore as a performance or as an accommodation to somebody else's wants, but as a way of really sharing yourself. So, when I was 14 and I had my first boyfriend, I met him at the steak dance. And and so every temple trip and everything like that, I was getting to know him better. And so I knew at some point I was going to kiss him. And maybe I was 15, I don't remember. But so I went and got my friend to buy a book for me that was called How to Kiss with Confidence, right? And it was all the techniques of how to kiss and how to do it well and to not make a fool of yourself. But the thing is, I wasn't interested in intimacy with him. I didn't really want him to know me. I didn't want him to see me as a fledgling, clueless person who'd never kissed before. I wanted him to see me as competent, as, I wanted to be presentable. And so that's not about intimacy, but so many of us think in the sexual realm, we aren't trying we're trying to perform or we're trying to be sufficient. We're not really letting ourselves be experienced. And again, I will talk about this tomorrow, giving couples some exercises around how to let themselves manage their anxiety, to let themselves be experienced more and to experience the other person. Yeah.
Talked about that exercise that you did with the couples when you have them hug. What are they supposed to be feeling? You know what I mean? So they are kind of feeling free and not full of that anxiety. What were you wanting out of that exercise? What were you wanting out of that exercise with that, with the couple when you had them hug? What, you know how?
I can't do it justice. I will talk about it tomorrow. Are you going to be here tomorrow? No. Okay. It's really around the mastery of holding on to yourself while you're that connected with another person, both physically and emotionally. Because when we're referencing externally, we are tracking what they're doing. And if we think they're annoyed or they don't want to be hugging us or they're, you know, sucking the life out of us, that often what happens is we abandon our own experience and we start trying to manage what they want or don't want. Right? So it's really about staying more grounded in yourself, even in the context of them wanting different things. And that's really the nuance of differentiation, is it actually allows you to be with them more, rather than regulating what you do through them. But it takes skill. You develop it. Okay. Let me just see where we are first before. Okay, I think...
So I really like this idea of sexuality being a self-progression and becoming more of a whole person. And I'm just wondering what kind of room, or does it leave any room for, like, chemistry? Like, when somebody says, well, I don't feel chemistry, is that sort of a cop-out of being vulnerable? Like, if you were just, like, in tune more with your sexuality, you could be intimate with anybody? Or does chemistry still play a role?
I don't know. Sorry. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know that you could just be... I guess I would say no. I don't think you'd just be sexual with anyone. I think if you had an arranged marriage and you never, ever felt anything ever, you know, maybe there's nothing to be restored or found. But the thing is, I think the real question is, do I want this person? I mean, I think usually what we do is we devalue them and we split desire off from them. Again, I'll talk about this tomorrow, as a way to manage vulnerability. But it's really not a function that there's never been anything there or never could be anything there. It's really about whether or not we value them. And I think that valuing of the other person is really about whether or not we can tolerate dependency. So I think the questions, and I have a lot of questions in your packet that you can answer on your own, but I think around this sense of, do I want to let myself be known more? I'm not there to accommodate him, to take care of him, but can I really see if I can, do I feel that it's legitimate for me to ask for our sexual relationship to be a reflection of the two of us? Is it legitimate for me to really let myself be known and experienced? Am I okay enough to let myself be known to myself, right? Can I share myself as an equal with him, flaws and all? And I think that's really the question that you have to confront in yourself. I don't have one of the packets up here, but there's several... you know what? I'll get to that. I'll talk about the packet at the end, so I'll explain to you what's there. Some more thoughts is that, another reason why holding your legitimacy is linked to desire is because the more confident you are with yourself, the more that, you will express who you are. And I think eroticism requires a basic level of self-esteem, you know, that you have to have a certain kind of healthy entitlement to pleasure, that you deserve it. You feel like you're worthy of it. And I think many of us carry a question around whether or not we're worthy of good things in our lives, whether or not we're really worthy of somebody, of our spouse, being uncomfortable for our sake, right? Of really giving to us. Like one couple that I work with where she has difficulty having an orgasm with him and he really wants to help her. And so he starts trying to help her. And then she starts thinking, oh my gosh, I'm taking too long. And her anxiety is going up and up and up, which is making it so it's less and less likely to happen. And the longer she takes, the more she feels like a burden, the more she feels frustrated, the more she feels disgusted with herself. And then just says, forget it. I just don't want to do this, right? The real issue for her is I think she has a hard time. I mean, there's several factors, but one of the issues is she has a really hard time letting herself feel that it's legitimate for her to be given to. Like, as one of the responses here, like, will my desires hurt someone else? Is it okay for someone to be, you know, be inconvenienced for my sake? And am I worthy of that? Or can I just run to the taking care of everyone else as a way to quickly feel like I'm valuable, because I'm at least valuable to them, but never can sort of own it in me? And one of the exercises, not in the packet, that I give women who I think really struggle with this, is to just let themselves be the receivers only, and to manage the anxiety around letting themselves receive. To just, you know, have an exploration in which you're discovering what you like and he's just giving to you in that way. And can you take it in and let yourself feel that it's okay, that it's okay to be given to, that I matter enough to receive it? So in short, healthy desire is really a capacity that we develop. And culturally, we talk about desire as something that's quantifiable, that either you have it or you don't. We talk about it as though hormones determine it. And while, of course, you know, the body, sexuality is embedded in the body, it's a lot more flexible than we tend to acknowledge. It's when the context changes how desire can like turn on a dime. And so it's oftentimes the meanings that we've created in our marriages that have snuffed it out so much that we feel like we must have a biological issue, right? But often all it takes is someone else flirting with your husband, right? And suddenly all the desire is back because now risk has been introduced, right? Because uncertainty has been introduced again. And so it's really around sort of challenging that tacitly agreed upon kind of safety that happens in the marriage, that when you challenge it can really allow desire to emerge again. Just the core of the idea that I've been talking about is that the more solid our sense of self is, the more differentiated we are, the more that we can validate who we are, then the more capacity we have to really want another person, to really let ourselves take in and embrace the other person that's there next to us. Low desire can be a reflection of your spouse's undesirable characteristics. You know, low desire can be an act of good judgment, right? Right. But sometimes low desire reflects our limited ability to really care for and let ourselves want another person, be dependent on another person. Let me just ask some questions before I go on. Questions or any clarification?
Okay. As I keep thinking about this, what about if you've been married for a while and you've got some bad habits? You get to where you kind of ignore each other. You've been raising your kids and now you're in a different place. Your hormones are in there. And what if he doesn't pay attention to you all day and then he expects you to at night and you're feeling like you don't connect? I mean, you just got a lot of bad habits and you learn to separate, but you feel so lonely. And how to bring the good habits back into your life?
So what I would say is the change is in the core is around self-validation and desire. And what I mean by that is you say, what kind of marriage do I have? What kind of marriage do I want? And I want to talk to him about what I think we have and what it is that I want. But it requires my ability to hold on to myself and my legitimacy to actually speak for something to change. Because usually when one person gets the idea that they want things to change, very seldom does the other person applaud it. Because then it requires they have to confront something in themselves that the other situation allowed them to avoid. So again, it's really around, and part of it, you know, let me just give this story. There's a couple I've been working with where, she's been the low desire partner for a long time. And she did that as a way of kind of trying to move into a sort of infancy in the, what's the better way to say it? She pulled into that low desire position as a way to not have to really expose herself, to really be vulnerable. And because he was so eager to be a caretaker, which he was, that she could use his guilt and her neediness as a way to get him to accommodate to her fear around sexuality. And he would move into the nurturing role and they wouldn't have sex. And that's really the way the marriage went for a long time, until he kind of came to a breaking point and said, I don't think I can be in a marriage that's so sexless, right? So the first thing that we worked on with her was around this issue, around her always moving into this kind of needy stance and then asking him to come in and be a caretaker. And instead, to let herself confront herself more, to see herself more, to see her ability to do that to him, all of which made her feel awful in a very good way. Meaning she started recognizing what she was doing to him, and she confronted it and she didn't like it. And so she started to emerge and to like tolerate the difficult conversations and to calm herself down enough to really hear what he was saying and to really respond, not just go into the crying that she used to do that would get him to stop talking, but to say, I think you're right. And I have been doing that. And I understand what you're saying and I'm sorry and so on. And so she just got to be much more solid. And so the relationship got better. And she also started confronting her anxiety around being sexual with him, where initially she always felt like she was in a performance, like she would sort of see herself sexually through his eyes and she'd want to look right and she'd want to sort of behave in the right way and make the right kinds of sounds and, you know, like be what she thought he wanted, which of course wasn't intimacy at all, right? And so she started referencing it through herself. What do I want? I want to be inside of my own skin while I'm with him. And so she started doing a lot of these things. But as she did it, she started to confront that he, you know, in spite of all the changes she was making, which were sincere ones, not perfect, but sincere, genuine movement, that he still was always saying she wasn't doing enough. He was still kind of looking down his nose at her, which had been an implicit part of the way that he'd related to her. That even though he was running in and being this caretaker, the way he managed it was to feel above her, that she was so needy and so fragile. And even though she was really growing up and standing up, that had really worked for him. It made him feel like he was so full of desire and so capable as a human being and such a good person without him ever having to really let himself be known to her. See what I mean? So when she started becoming more capable of intimacy, he just kept saying, well, you haven't done enough. I don't think you're trying hard enough. And always was trying to keep himself above it. And so she started to speak genuinely to that and saying, I don't like this. I don't like the way that you don't take influence from me. I don't like the way that you're always seeing me as less than you, that I'm not worthy of you. And to which he would not take her influence and he would look down his nose at her comments. But anyway, and he would say, well, I feel like you're just talking about this, but you're still not working on yourself, right? You're not working on our sexual relationship. My response to that was, she's absolutely working on your sexual relationship, because she's saying, I am confronting myself enough. I know what I've done to you and I see it. I also know I really want to be with you, but I don't want to be with you if you're constantly holding yourself above me. I'm asking you to come and really be with me. And if you can't come and be with me, I don't want to be with you in this way. Right? And that's an act of self-differentiation, right? That's an act of being true to herself and true to him at the same time, right? So improving sexual relationships is very much linked to improving emotional relationships. It's really around growing up. Okay. I would say that sexual desire, or developing sexual desire, is not about becoming less of a failure to your high desire spouse, right? So many of us who are in that low desire position, we feel like there's something wrong with us. You know, we have all the power in the relationship. Our spouse would say we have all the power because we have the right of refusal, but we have none of the status, right? That we're seen as less than for not wanting. And so oftentimes if you're thinking that your low desire is a function of you being insufficient, what Schnarch would say about this is that high desire people and low desire people in the same relationship, you know, in your relationship, are no more differentiated than the other. The higher desire person, even though they're wanting, is no more differentiated. Just like the couple I just told you about, he looked like he was so healthy. He looked like he had a healthy relationship to desire. But when she was actually offering him more intimacy, he was too afraid to actually come and be there with her. You see what I mean? So it's not about becoming less defective. It's really about joining with yourself more, coming home to yourself more, claiming the whole of your God-given body and embracing it as yours. So I just want to transition into, this is the part in the packets. I think just part of knowing who you are and is knowing who you are as a sexual being, there's value in understanding how I got to where I am. So the first one is just my relationship to sexuality, questions for exploration. This is just an amalgam of questions, some of which I ask clients when they first come in and I do an assessment, just various questions, some that other researchers or theorists have talked about. It's just a way of understanding what are the messages that I internalized as a child about sexuality from my family, from my young women's teachers. What did I take in and what did I really, what shaped me? And how did I see my parents? What messages did I learn from them? Did you see your parents as sexual beings? And how did you know that they were or weren't? Was the door locked sometimes? Did they take weekends away? Did they express affection openly? Or did they recoil from touch or avoid it? How did your parents relate to you in terms of touch? Was there anxiety around touch? Was withholding touch a way of punishing? One of the things that I bring up in here, just for me to explain a little bit, is this is something that Esther Perel, a clinician in New York City, talks about, is did you see your parents as primarily as a couple, as individuals, or as parents, right? Because it will speak a lot to how you see your parents' relationship to their own desires. If you saw your parents as, you know, as your mom, for example, as primarily a parent more than she was an individual or as part of a couple, then you might have a harder time integrating the legitimacy of desire, of your own autonomy, of you being a person in your own right, that it might feel more compelling for you that the only way to sort of legitimately be in the world is through nurturing of others, right? So oftentimes the ways our parents oriented to themselves taught us volumes about how to relate to ourselves. And I think, there's more questions on the back, but I think the question for you to ask yourself is, basically through that exploration, is where am I relative to what my family taught me, implicitly or explicitly, about sexuality? And what messages have I kept? What messages have I let go of? And what messages, you know, what would I still like to change? What do I want to be in the sexual realm? And really think about that. Because, again, if it's only defined through what your spouse wants, it really is not going to ever become meaningful for you. It really has to be, what do I want in the sexual realm? And then perhaps, what are two ways that I can actively challenge myself to develop in my relationship to my sexuality? And I give some examples of different things you may want to do. I have, the next one is exercises around what you, learning about what you like in the sexual realm. Now again, this is all, you know, I could give a packet like this to people and they will never ever do it, right? And the reason they won't do it is not because they're so busy, even though they say it. That's why. Meaning like this stuff here, like doing things with your spouse and figuring out what it is you really like. The reason they won't do it is they don't want to be known, right? And so until you're ready to let yourself be more known, you're not going to ever get around to doing these things. So it really has to be done in a context of I want to know myself more, and I want to confront my fear of having him know me more. And maybe I can think about what I want and what I like and communicate that to him and give myself the space to figure that out. You know, one of the exercises I give people sometimes is, you know, I gave this to a couple that I'm working with where I was saying, why don't you let him touch you, and you can just give him a scale of 1 to 10, how pleasurable it is. You know, the varying kinds of touch, touching you in different places. And the thing is that because she felt so much like she was defective sexually, that she just never wanted to do the exercise because she was afraid that it would always be a 2. And what if every way he touched her was a 1 or a 2? That then it proves that she's not whole, and he would give up hope on her. And so, again, it was this feeling, it's not that, see, if she could tolerate the anxiety of stepping into that possibility, then she could actually manage her anxiety and actually probably start to experience a lot more pleasure. But the anxiety actually inhibited the pleasure and also then kept her from wanting to do it because she felt so much like it made her worth less, right? So I'm just saying all that because these are all great exercises, but if you're not really willing to know yourself more, then you won't do them. So, okay. Let me just see. I also have a page in here about painful intercourse that's taken from Barry McCarthy's work, and also guidelines around orgasm and arousal and orgasm. Painful intercourse is something that... it's not a psychological issue, meaning there are physiological reasons for it. And so going to, and it talks about it in the worksheet, just going to specialists that can help you understand what's happening is necessary. And I would also say that in my experience in working with people, that as women get more aroused and open themselves, they're not just in an accommodating stance, then their bodies do become more aroused, and they're less anxious, and therefore it's less painful, right? That they start experiencing less pain often. Okay. So knowing your sexual narrative is a part of self-knowledge.
You're not saying anything about physical appearance. And I
do you want to say anything? Questions?
No, just that it plays some role, even if people... It's people feeling that they aren't attractive enough, or if it's that they're not attractive.
I'll jump to that section. That's good.
Women are taught to relate to themselves and their bodies as objects, right? Objects to be desired by males. And women learn to observe rather than experience themselves. And there's a lot of feminist research on this, that men have, women have ornamental value and men have something like functional. It's, I can't remember what the instrumental value. Yes, all right. So, and you know, one of the things I talk about is that, you know, men, the language of the body, sensuality, touch, and all that. That's our, as Esther Perel in her words, that's our mother tongue, right? That's the language in which we learn to communicate love, acceptance, belonging. Cherishing is through the body. When your baby is held, caressed, it's sensual. That's the only way you can express to them your love for them and their safety. And that what happens, though, is that for girls at the time of puberty and adolescence, they are really socialized out of a comfort with their body. Because that script that I talked about around becoming desirable, right? Now your body has to be shaped, perfected, contained, managed. And now your body's no longer yours. I mean, think about how you were in that prepubescent state of just running around without a thought in the world with respect to your body, that once you hit adolescence, now you're, you know, it's not shaped the right way. You're not tall enough. Your legs aren't long enough. You're not whatever enough. There's all this kind of scrutiny of the body. And it really leads women to feel a kind of that they disconnect from their bodies, and they feel, as one of my clients said, I feel betrayed by my body. You know, that my body has never been thin enough. It doesn't give me orgasms, is what she was saying. She felt like, you know, my body has never been my friend. And And so it really creates that mind-body split and really undermines confidence and self-knowledge and our strength. I think one of the reasons why boys continue, you know, into men, feel more comfortable expressing vulnerability and tenderness and intimacy in the sexual realm is because they're still very comfortable in the language of the body. And yet women are much women would rather talk, you know, rather than express it through the body. So men often haven't experienced that same split. So I think for many women to engage in sex is to focus on one's perceived inadequacies rather than on pleasure and connection. Am I desirable to him? Does he want me? It's hard to feel desire when you think you have to be desirable. And especially when that standard of desirability is so stringent and so demanding, right? It's so exacting. And I think these can be really intensified if you were sexually violated in any way. Here's my kind of simple answer to, I think, what's a challenging issue. I think two people that have done a lot of work in this area, one is named, hang on, I'll think of it. Let me just say it, and I'll come back to her name in a second. Janine Roth, G-E-N-E-E-N-R-O-T-H, Janine Roth, writes a lot about our relationship to food and the body, right? And that at the core of a healthy relationship to ourselves, not to mention a healthy relationship to food and a relationship to our bodies, is deep self-acceptance and self-nurturance. And so that's really, you know, she, the author, was an anorexic and bulimic and became suicidal through the deep self-rejection and the rejection of her body. And really, her movement into health was around embracing her imperfect body and embracing herself in the process. I think that it's really around our courage to both reject the cultural expectation. I mean, most of us have spouses who think we are plenty attractive, but we often will still not accept that as true because we hold a higher standard for ourselves. And, you know, that our attractiveness to them is so much broader than just whether or not we've put extra weight on our thighs. It has to do with the whole of who we are that's appealing. And yet, if we don't feel like we fit that standard, we will project that rejection onto them, and we'll reject that we don't feel entitled to the pleasure. I'm not worthy of it because look at me. I think the way to grow out of it is around really being more willing to embrace who you are, flaws and all. That I matter. That my body is legitimate. That it's mine. That I am imperfect, and yet I deserve to be connected with this person who loves me. I deserve to have pleasure with him. I'm not here to perform for him in some way or be something for him. I want to validate myself enough to let myself be with him as I am. So it's easier to say it than to do it. Janine Roth is one author who's a good resource, and the other one is Judith Motz, M-A-T-Z. Judith Motz, and she writes a lot about relationship to the body and food. There's other people that write just about body image, but I just can't remember who they are right now. But the others are very good. Other questions or thoughts about that? Yeah. Oh, well, you can do about something else. Yes.
I just wondered if you'd say something about fantasizing, women and fantasizing. I've heard, oh, it's normal, all women do it. It's, you know, and then I've heard it's disconnecting from your body.
So what I would say is if you, let's give the kind of the most helpful answer. So one book that I read called, it actually isn't Passionate Thoughts. I always give the wrong title. It's something else. It's the author is Wendy Maltz. Wendy, W-E-N-D-Y, Maltz, M-A-L-Z, or T-Z maybe. It's Passionate Thoughts. It's not what it is. Passionate something. And it's about fantasies, women in fantasies. You'll find, if you Google her name, you'll see the book. She basically cataloged all of her research around the things that women fantasize about, okay? and it's an interesting book. but she kind of categorized it, and she doesn't, I don't think she says this in her book, but kind of as I looked at it, it was pretty clear that, maybe she does talk about this, but it was pretty clear that the more relational trauma you experienced, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, the more you have a split between love and desire in your fantasies, and in your relationships, that you split desire off from love. And in fantasy, you will do it also. So fantasies have the power to teach you a lot about yourself. And fantasies, you know, can seem so perverse and so weird and kind of, why would that idea turn me on? That must mean I'm really a disgusting person or something like that. They really, in many ways, are trying to undo the things that have been very hard for us. They're kind of like dreams, that there's a meaning in a way that actually, if something is arousing, it is a source of anxiety for us. And oftentimes, we're trying to kind of master a situation. And so, Wendy Maltz writes about that, also another author, and I can't think of the author's name. It's a psychoanalyst. He talks, it's a very compelling book, really, talks about the meaning in fantasy and what is often we're trying to undo and reconcile within ourselves. I think the thing about fantasy is that fantasy can tell you something about what it is you're trying, something about yourself. So, for example, one of my clients never used fantasy. She felt like it was a kind of betrayal. She also had no desire. And, but I asked her to think about, what is it, if you were to let yourself think about what ideas turn you on, what turns you on? And she said, I have a fantasy of being a waitress and having multiple men, you know, knocking over tables to get to me, right? Okay. I asked her husband what his fantasies were, and he said, to have sex with her, which was largely in the fantasy realm at that point. So, okay. So the thing is about her is she was ashamed of that. Like, what a weird thing for me to want. But if you really looked at her life history, she had a family in which there were very high demands placed on her around excelling in school, which she had done, around always sort of behaving in a competent way, always sort of being on top of things, always in control, which was part of her challenge in the sexual realm, is letting go of some of that. The fantasy was precisely the opposite, right? Is here she was in a low-status position, and yet she was that wanted. Even when she had, you know, even when there was nothing about her that was compelling, she was a waitress, right? And also this idea that I could be that wantable, that people would sort of defy convention to get access to me, that's compelling, right? So there's oftentimes, there's meanings in the fantasies that can help you learn something about what it is that you're unsettled about within yourself. The other thing I'd say about fantasy is I do think, again, I'll talk about this tomorrow. I'm sorry to keep saying that. But when you have a hard time tolerating the intimacy of a sexual connection, like people turn out the lights and they disconnect as a way to actually make the interaction less intimate, right? And a way to make it less intimate is to think about somebody else, right? Or to be emotionally disengaged and thinking about something else. And I'm not here to make it inherently bad, but it, or pathologize it, just to say that the more we can really let ourselves be present, you know, the more we can really be with the person we are with and feel desire at the same time, right? More that we can really be connected. You can share what your fantasies are too. That's another way of sharing who you are. But whether or not it's intimate maybe is how the fantasy is used, and whether it's used to disconnect or whether it's used to connect.
I have a question about polarities. Like, do you ever see a lot of people going from no sex to addiction, or having someone get into the victim framework and the husband's the predator? Do you see a lot of people swinging from no sex to addiction, or putting themselves in the victim role and the husband's the predator? Is that anything? Like the woman who wants no sex, feeling like the victim, and the male's the predator. Yeah, or like he wants it and I have to give it because I'm obligated, you know.
So Well, what I would say, what I think often happens, especially when there's been sexual trauma, is in the context of a committed relationship, often that person will become non-sexual, present as almost asexual. But then in relationships that matter far less, meaning with strangers, and they can be hypersexual. So that's not unusual for people that have really disowned the vulnerability of sex, right? Won't bring that vulnerability into a relationship that actually matters, but will, you know, use it to feel desired or to feel powerful in relationships that don't matter. So I do see that. And then in terms of the victim predator, I mean, I would say, it sounds like what you're saying is just an extreme version of what I'm talking about, where someone moves into the non-desire and then the spouse goes into a very high desire position and they seem very polarized. And it's kind of managing something for both of them. I guess I have sort of touched on this already, but I just want to talk about this a little bit more. You know, I would say one more thing about our bodies. You know, sexual gaze is really important. Like the kind of, you know, if you think about some professor in my husband's education said, you know, I think it was him, that if you look anybody in the eye for more than 4 seconds or something, 7 seconds, you're either going to kill them or have sex with them. Right? That it's like an intensely intimate kind of communication, right? And people have actually talked about, like, right before when someone held up a gun to them, that when you looked in that person's eyes and you knew they were going to kill you, there was something intensely intimate about that moment. You know what I mean? So I'm sure none of you know what I mean. I mean, hopefully none of us have experienced it. But so there is something very powerful about gaze, and that happens a lot in courtship. It often happens much less in marital sexuality. And something about letting ourselves really have eye contact is about letting ourselves really be seen and seeing the other person, okay? The other thought I have is gazing at ourselves. You know, I think if we look at ourselves, who do I see? And who do I think he sees? Do I see myself as attractive? Do I see myself as wantable? Do I see myself as somebody who can be desired, right? Even if my body is imperfect. Because I think if we can't hold that in ourselves, we're going to have a very hard time letting someone else feel it for us. Oh, I forgot about something. Okay, so we got to get to this. Okay, so I forgot. I'm not even going to use this. Okay. I think that, you know, speaking of an erotic education, we talked a little bit about self-exploration. Let me tell you this, that Laura Brotherson in her book talks about this notion of knowing our body's capacity for eroticism, and she talks about it in terms of self-learning. She doesn't call it masturbation. She calls it self-learning, kind of a cleaned-up way of talking about coming to know yourself. She distinguishes it from masturbation because masturbation is something to take your sexuality outside of the relationship. Self-learning is to know yourself well enough to know to bring that into the relationship and to create the connection. So that was written in her book, and that gets sold at Deseret Book. So okay, so if there's any legitimacy, maybe it's there from the larger church. Okay. I think many of us as women, we basically make our spouses responsible for turning us on, for making us want. That's kind of the cultural script, that if he's really a man, he'll make me want it. You know, if he's really a man, he'll make me feel pleasure. But I think we really are responsible for our own sexuality and for our own ability to feel turned on. So this is one thing I just want to do. Throw out your responses if you dare. This is easy. We'll start with this. I turn myself off when, and just think about how do you turn yourself off sexually? What kinds of things make you turn yourself off from wanting? Yeah. When I'm too tired. Too tired. Oh, it's going to be hard to write. Too tired. Okay. I probably need a scribe, maybe. Too tired. What's another? What? What? Okay, hearing the kids. Good. When I'm angry at them. What else? You guys know how to turn yourselves off. I know it. Come on. Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's kind of hard to sort of hold the board while you do it. What else? When do you turn yourself off?
When you don't allow yourself to be kind of like in the moment, you're focused, not focusing on the moment, like, oh yeah, what groceries do I need? What's happening tomorrow?
Okay. Right. So, right, when I let the distractions overcome desire. When I turn myself off when I feel unattractive, when I feel worried about my children, when I feel like he's placating me, when I feel like he doesn't care about me. Come on, you guys know. When do you turn yourselves off? When you don't have enough time. When he's not turned on. When I think he's not turned on. Good. When I see myself in my garments. Good. I know. Make him a little sexier. Okay. What else? Yeah. Say it loudly. Feeling touched out, right? When I don't want to, when I don't want to feel taken from. Yeah. Yes. When I feel exhausted by demands. Okay. Let me just see if I have any more that I wrote here. Okay. Okay, now let's do, I turn myself on. It's always harder to get from people. I turn myself on when, so I'll give you some, when I feel attractive, when I feel successful, when I feel understood and accepted.
When someone's flirting with my husband.
That's a great one, yes. Right? I turn myself on when?
When I pamper
myself, good. When?
When I have no responsibilities.
When I have no responsibilities, that's awesome. Yes? I turn myself on when? The kids are asleep. Good. I turn myself on when I buy sexy clothing and imagine myself wearing it, okay? What else? I turn myself on when? I feel loved. What else?
Romantic music.
When I have romantic music. Good. When I feel admiration for him. When he seems confident. When he seems not needy. Right?
I have
friends. When you dance?
No, a friend of mine says,
when she... To dance. Yeah, great. Yeah, dancing is very sensual. Okay, good. So, and you can see how many of these things have nothing to do with sex, right? They have something to do with our relationship to ourselves and our relationship to the other person. But if you're wondering kind of what is the key for me feeling more desire, it may lie in this area, like what do I need to do more of for myself? Also, thinking about the act of turning yourself off, what am I protecting myself from when I do that? Why am I shutting myself down in those moments? I have one more, and I'm not going to write it, but I just want you to think about it, just thinking about sort of what's the source of desire for you, is the question of, I'm most drawn to my spouse when... When? One of my clients said like a turning point for her was the other day when a skunk climbed under the porch and died, and the odor was so bad that it was just oppressive. She could barely deal with it. And she asked her husband if he would come home and take care of it. And he came home early, and she said he went out there and he got that skunk and he picked it up by the tail, and it, like, a body fell off, and the kids were like highly entertained, and she just like saw him as such a man in that moment, you know? And he's like taking that skunk on, and he like buried it in the backyard, and she was like so blown away by like him coming in and rescuing her from this, and you know, seeing him be able to do something that she knew she could never do for herself, right? When you see, admire something in your spouse, that makes you drawn to them, right? Difference is really at the core of attraction. And so when we let ourselves witness the difference, that can draw us to our spouse. What else? I feel drawn to my spouse when? What?
He rubs my feet.
When he rubs my feet. Okay, what else?
When he forgives me.
When he forgives me. Great. What else? Yeah.
When I know that he really wants the best for me, he's not mad at me, he's ever.
Great. When he really wants the best for me. Great.
When he spends time with me.
When he spends time with me. Great. When he helps with the kids. Right. This is like my husband, he's like foreplay for him. He's like getting a spoon and like, what, Jennifer? Is he dropping the spoon in the dishwasher? let's see. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'm drawn to my partner when I see him, you know, at a party and he's talking to other people and he sounds intelligent and I see him as other. You know, I see him as different. I see him as having strengths that I don't have. One theorist talks about the eye of the third, you know, like I'm sitting in Relief Society and I remember John, my husband, comes and opens the door right in the front to get something from me and he just looked so handsome in that moment and like everybody looked at him and that was like, wow, he's mine, right? Like they see him and I get to have him and that you know, that yeah, I was very drawn to him right then, right? So oftentimes that, like when someone's flirting with my husband, I feel drawn. But oftentimes it's when we feel sort of like we have so much togetherness, there's not enough space for wanting. And oftentimes when we're really drawn is when we see them as separate and other. So I'm saying all that as this kind of a fun way to start thinking about what is it that draws me in? When do I find myself wanting? And can I encourage and elicit more of that? And when I turn myself off, what am I trying to protect? And what am I trying to shut down in me? And can I work with that to hold something inside of myself more, that I make more space for desire? So we are out of time. If you want to come tomorrow and you haven't signed up, there is still room. You can just come tomorrow and pay, or you can pay online if you want. And that starts at 10 a.m. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to